insightful analysis, bold comments, friendly debates. Find all that on Roundtable, an in-depth discussion on hot topics in China, only on Easy FM.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of Roundtable, coming to you from China Radio International's headquarters in Beijing. I'm your host, He Yang. What you are going to hear today is when we took the show to New York. We had a roundtable discussion with Chinese and American college students on politics, food, culture, the future, and many more topics from different perspectives. Mr. Lee Harris, anchor of the radio show 1010 Winds in New York City, was with me, hosting the roundtable-style discussion from university to the world. CRI has conducted an online survey on our app China Plus to find out what college students think about the relationship between China and the U.S. And of course, their personal development perspective involved in that backdrop. And valid questionnaires have been collected from 500 Chinese college students and 350 American students. So here we've found some concrete answers to some of these interesting questions and also some very interesting findings. So here, let's have a look at the screen
of
this
and the
video
US
clip to find out
about
more on
each
this.
Other and other countries. China Radio International conducted an online survey to find out. First impression? 53% of American students think hardworking is the most outstanding characteristic of Chinese people. Intelligence came in second place. 47% of Chinese students think Americans are open and easygoing. 45% think Americans are always full of confidence. Favorite place to visit? 33% of American students chose metropolitan cities like Beijing or Shanghai as the most desired place to visit in China. 25% chose historical cities like Hangzhou or Chengdu. Another 25% chose natural scenic spots like Guilin. Chinese students are also interested in big cities in the U.S. Their most desired city to visit is Seattle, followed by New York, and in third place, Los Angeles. Most respected person. 47% of American students chose Confucius as their most respected Chinese person. Jackie Chan ranks second, with Jack Ma ranking third. On the Chinese side, President Obama, Abraham Lincoln, and Kobe Bryant are the three most popular Americans among Chinese students. Favorite Chinese food? American students selected fried rice, chow mein, dumplings, and wonton soup as their favorite Chinese dishes. And what did the Chinese students recommend? Beijing roast duck, boiled fish, dong po pork, scrambled egg with tomato, and a lot more. On bilateral ties, 36% of American students think China is the most important country to the U.S., but still 39% think U.S.-Europe relations are of vital importance. 66% of Chinese students think Sino-U.S. relations are the most important to China. Looking ahead for future bilateral ties, the top 10 words used by American students are improving, strained, complicated, friendly, tense, stronger, growing, unsure, interesting, and uncertain. While Chinese students choose these words, cooperation, friendly, harmony, win-win, peace, interest, tense, seek common ground while reserving differences, compatible, and hand-in-hand.
That is a fascinating data set. I was riveted. looking at those responses. Just want to say one thing to Michael. If that chemistry thing doesn't work out, I think we can get you a gig on the radio station. So really good. It's fun to look at the difference, particularly as regards the relationships between the two countries and how they're perceived. So looking ahead 4 years to 2020, a lot of water could pass under the bridge between now and then. What kind of relationship do you think the U.S. and China will have? Could go a bunch of different ways, and whoever has a thought on the matter is free to speak.
Okay, so I'll say, as of right now, I don't feel like U.S.-China relations are as good as they could be, especially since there's a lot of economic tension between the two countries. As of recently, China, by some measures, surpassed the U.S. in terms of economic size, and just as Americans, we don't really like competition that threatens us. We like competition to push us along, but we don't like competition that actually poses a danger to us, you know, either in terms of military or economic or political from those standpoints. And we also have the issue with North Korea now, and just that uncertainty creates some anti-Asian, anti-Chinese sentiment among Americans, not among all, fortunately, amongst more than we would like.
And Franklin had something to say.
Yeah, I agree, but, well, I think the key word about the Sino-American relationship in the future coming along, I think, would be the mutual respect, because, of course, there are competition, there are contention, it's totally normal, but, I mean, just as our former Premier Wen Jiabao said, the mutual benefit between China and America far outweigh the, you know, the hostility, I think. So, yeah, and especially we can certainly see like a cultural convergence between China and America. Look, I'm a Chinese student, I'm wearing Jordan, I'm wearing Nike. Yeah, I mean, I love it. So you can see like U.S. popular culture is penetrate like so deep into like Chinese like modern life. And I believe the same process is actually happening here in America as well, because we can see like Kung Fu Panda, we can see like, you know, we can see like Hua Mulan, things like that, and there are more and more Asian faces here in America. I believe this is a good sign. It's like a healthy relationship based on mutual respect.
What would we need to do on either side to straighten things out, do you think?
I would say basically it's about the young generation, because we can see like most of the Asian faces that I just mentioned are students study abroad here. Right? So can we expect like there will be like more American students studying in China? Because that is actually the best way to get into the culture and take it back. Then you can have like a more efficient cultural convergence.
So I really appreciate the description from Chinese students. So I would use seeking common ground despite of all the difference to describe the U.S.-China relationship. It also strikes me to see there are different set of language used to describe the different relationship. The Chinese students sometimes are like more positive, diplomatic, and those words are also seen in our media around us, like from the social network platforms, from televisions and from radio stations. And the American students are always more like critical, sometimes conservative, sometimes positive. I would say both are good things.
Thank you. And I think that does touch upon one of the differences that Chinese people and people elsewhere maybe have. That is, I think Chinese people are very diplomatic and we're peace seekers. We don't like confrontations. We like things to be peaceful, and we respect each other. At least that's what Confucius taught us.
I agree with Danqin and Franklin, but on the other hand, I totally can understand what Michael has said, and I think that's what most Americans are worried about. That is the suicide trap, by which I mean that existing power may be afraid of the rising power. But what we need to pay attention is that I believe China and U.S. can avoid suicide trap because we are not Spartan and America are not Asians. Just like He Yang has said, we Chinese are peace seekers. We are not like Spartan, want to take the place of Athens. So I believe that China and U.S. can cooperate with each other very well in the future, and I believe we can make joint efforts in making this world a better environment for us to live in.
And yes, the beautiful lady with gold necklace, it's your time to shine.
One point I think I'd like to bring up in terms of like a type of global currency other than money is language. And I think that English, for better or for worse, has become one of the global languages. And if you look at, you know, students in China, from my understanding, are, you know, required to learn English at a very young age and are taught from a very young age that English is a necessary skill in order to compete globally or to compete in China. Whereas if you look in the United States, students don't have to learn second languages at an early age. The first time, you know, a language class had ever been recommended to me was when I was in high school. And by then it wasn't mandatory. It wasn't compulsory. So I think that students in America have this luxury, which in my opinion is really just by chance based on where you're born, that the whole feels as if the world, you know, revolves around them because they have this, you know, they have this ability to speak English and they grow up with English and it's their native language and everyone has to adjust to them. So I think that for American students, having the shared language between Europe and America makes them feel closer, but maybe, you know, we're not thinking so much about the economic ties or the cultural ties or the, you know, the infrastructural ties between China and America moving forward. So I think language does play a big part between the relations.
If you're looking ahead, you're looking a little farther east than Europe. Speaking about looking ahead, in the year 2020, which is very far and also very close, we're likely talking about a China that is the primary number one economy in the world, and Michael already mentioned how that's perceived as a threat in some circles here in the United States, but maybe that can be turned into a positive as well. So tell me what you think about a world in 2020 where China is the premier economy. What difference will that make here in the States and maybe around the world?
A tough question. We're talking about predictions about what will happen in 2020. So here are some of the findings according to the CRI survey. One is saying that, yes, China will surpass the U.S. as the world's largest economy. What will happen? What will it entail from that? I'd be very interested to hear from you guys. And also other predictions from Chinese and U.S. college students have been the U.S. will overtake China as the world's largest manufacturing power.
And don't forget, it's been an American century. America has been the superpower economically and militarily for 100 years. So this is a major shift.
Yes, and it's kind of like shifting back, I feel, because China has been known as the manufacturing hub for some time, but often on not very much value-added products. But how will China change? And we know that in the U.S., there's a lot of skilled workers and a lot of high-skilled products are being produced and manufactured here. So what is the future about that? And also look at China will become the largest source of foreign tourists to the U.S. As I don't know if you guys know, there's one stat that only 5% of Chinese tourists have left the country to visit places. And we already know what kind of buying power Chinese people have demonstrated already. In the future, Chinese people seem to want to come to U.S. a lot, and 1 million American students to learn Chinese. That's a promise that Mr. President Obama has made to our President Xi Jinping. So yes, guys, a lot of these predictions have been made. Which one do you agree with? And please explain to us why.
I would say that by 2020, I think that the biggest change that I see is that the United States would know more about China and more about the real culture of China. Because what I sense, especially before I was in Shanghai, is that most Americans, I mean, I come from the middle of America, so I maybe not say most Americans, but the people I interact with often have an idea of China that's still rooted in maybe the 1960s era, still a little bit backwards. We have this idea of them being China being the manufacturer for the United States. But really my time in China and my time interacting with Chinese international students studying in the United States has really taught me a lot. And I think I definitely see young people like the people on the stage now who are going out of their way to cross borders, to do culture exchange. These will be the people that will be leading the education of American public about what China really is now. Because I don't know if we're still seeing it in media yet, but we are, as you were saying, we are learning it today in the back room. We're learning more about Chinese popular culture as well. And I think that's going to be the biggest change in 2020.
I think it's got to be pretty hard at this point to go to a decent college in America and not meet more than a few Chinese people. Whereas when I was growing up, not too far from here, just outside New York City, I really didn't know any Chinese people. We saw them if we went to Chinatown, but that was about it. And whereas by the time I went to college, I actually got to know quite a few. So I think that helps. I think even in Springfield, where you're from, there are probably a few Chinese students wandering around. Yes?
I think as one of the younger panelists, I can speak a lot to like the rising number of Chinese speakers. As Mr. Lee said, like if you go to one of these universities, you will see a rise, like an increasing amount of Chinese students. People will be more compelled to learn Chinese, whether that be from an educative standpoint or economic. I agree with that. The reason I started speaking Chinese is because I knew that it was a rising country, both like economically and socially, and I wanted to understand more about like the history of it. The language is a huge part of the culture, both written and spoken.
Some days it just feels like the same place, I think, you know, when you're wandering around. Yeah, it's Chinese people here, it's American people over there. Let's move on to the tourism question, make it a little lighter at this point after all of the heavy stuff. I think everybody wants the people coming from the other country to come to their hometowns. Maybe not Springfield. You want people to come there?
I often tell people, so I'm from the middle of America, and I often tell my friends that it'd be a good idea to come to see a different facet of America, but I agree, there's not much to see.
I've been there.
But to touch on that, I think even Franklin was touching on it, that the type of Chinese people that come to the United States often are of a certain socioeconomic status. They are people who study English, the people that have the capital to come to the United States. And similarly, I think they often meet the people from the United States who are in the similar boat, not necessarily studying Chinese, but similar socioeconomic status. So I think to come to some different areas of the United States, for example, Springfield, Missouri, would give another glimpse into what it is like for the United States as well.
I want to share a story of my American friend, Hannah. Hannah came to my hometown, Hangzhou, a few years ago, and then we became friends. Hannah learned about the famous Hangzhou tale about the love story between the white snake spirit and Xu Xian, the mortal, in America. And she just idealized this story as her ideal love. So she studied Chinese in America for 2 years, came to Hangzhou, my hometown, looking for her Xu Xian, for her love. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that there are more Hannahs in China with their expectations on the U.S. America than there are Hannahs in America. There are so many tales that we heard in our childhood about New York, L.A., so many big cities, legendary people in movies, in sports. And I arrived in New York 2 days ago. We took some time touring the city. We saw scenes that we can name from shows like Gossip Girl and Friends. So I guess what we saw in the prediction is very true, that China has a growing middle class. We have more spending power. And when I applied for my trip here, I found out that I got a 10-year visa. So the thing is that it's easier and easier for people to get visas, to book planes with technology. And it's finally their time to see that the scene that they've seen so many times in movies, right? So I think that prediction is going to happen very, very soon, even earlier than 2020.
I think people can easily fall in love with some attractions from certain areas. My favorite city is San Francisco. because of the special like, ragged terrain of that special city.
San Francisco is also a very Chinese city by American standards, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I wonder if it's just Chinese students have been watching too much Grey's Anatomy, and then we pick Seattle as the most desired destination for Chinese people if we visit the U.S. for the very first time. Also, why do you think that for young people in both countries, we recommend it's the big cities that people want to go to, and then, but when you recommend it to your friend, what's the best place to go to in your own country? And then for Chinese students, we say it's the historical places. And for American students, they say that it's a place, maybe a small town, when you can see the real life of Americans, and it's not like Grey's Anatomy or Sex and the City in New York. Guys, our fellow American students, if I ask you to recommend a place to our fellow Chinese friends, what do you have to say regarding that?
I mean, if someone asked me what is the best place in the U.S. to visit, you know, answers that I should give are Los Angeles, New York, Seattle, you know, places in Florida, Texas, the more well-known places. I'm from Colorado, as I mentioned earlier, and it's just very different there. The average density is 40 people per square mile, something like that, where in New York it's literally millions of people per square mile. And it's, you know, a lot of mountain streams, evergreen forests as far as you can see. If you see a footprint, it's probably yours. just things like that. And it's just a very different setting. To me, it's more comfortable, and it's what I would really, really like to give someone as an answer. I mean, any picture that you take will look like you can put it on a postcard. And it's just a different mindset for some people. A lot of young people like the hustle and bustle of different cities. So you go to LA, you have a lot of movies, a lot of, you know, nice beaches, surfing, outdoor stuff. And you come to New York, you have films, you have TV, you have those kinds of things. And I guess just since we're young people, we like that sort of thing. We like the excitement, and we don't really want to settle for green meadows until we're 60. I guess that just accounts for the different answers that you'll get amongst students and the popularity of larger cities such as New York and Seattle. So.
Colorado also has legalized recreational marijuana going
yes.
forward.
actually, Seattle has as well.
And that
so,
too.
That may.
But you get better scenery there. So on a transitional note, we saw the survey on food, which was kind of hilarious because what passes for Chinese food in America and what passes for Chinese food in China, two very different things. I have yet to be served donkey at a U.S. Chinese restaurant, but I have had it in Beijing. What do they say? In heaven, dragon meat, on earth, donkey meat, right? So these two types of food have very little to do with each other. So if you had to recommend one dish from either side, what would you recommend from China to America and from America to China? If it's something that's not represented up there.
Okay, can I have it? Yeah, I definitely have to talk about this. Because, yeah, as I mentioned, I'm from Guangzhou, so you may be more familiar with the other name, Canton, if you know Cantonese. Mm-hmm. There's a term that just describes Cantonese food. It is dim sum. I mean, just to point out kind of truth, is there are like more than 60% of restaurants in Manhattan Chinatown are run by Cantonese.
Yes.
If you like the food there, that you should be falling in love with Cantonese food. Yeah, just to name a few, like the shrimp dumpling, which in Cantonese we call it ha gao, and like pork dumplings, siu mai, yeah, things like that. Just come over, I'll tell you, okay? I would recommend like a few restaurants that's really good, okay? Yeah, but Cantonese food, definitely, please, come to Guangzhou.
When I was, a little kid, we went down from New York to Washington, went to a Chinese restaurant in Washington, and we asked for noodles for the soup, and they said, oh, you are from New York.
That's precise.
So I'll add. So Springfield, Missouri, we keep coming back to this, oddly. But Springfield, Missouri prides themselves on being the creator, they say, of cashew chicken, which is believed to be like a Chinese delicacy. So I think that embodies really what America considers Chinese food, and that's often breaded fried chicken smothered in gravy with a side of rice. So that's what you'll find most places across the United States. And as Franklin was saying, I think historically, the most migrants from China do come from the south, do come from Guangzhou and Canton.
That's true.
A lot of the influence of Chinese food does come from there. So going to Shanghai made me really realize that Chinese food encompasses so much more. So now to say that I love eating Chinese food, it's true because I found very few types of Chinese food that I didn't like. But to say that I love eating Chinese food doesn't really cut it because there's so many different types of this Shanghai food, Sichuan food, even the food in Beijing. Mm-hmm. So I think Americans have an idea that's very simplified of it. So if I were to recommend anyone, these are some things that I was able to find in New York, but definitely not at home. Pei bo rou, like double cooked pork, xiao long bao, which is a big favorite.
We'll be back after this short break. Stay tuned for more Roundtable.
Informed opinion and heated debate. Find out what's got China talking on our Roundtable discussion, only on Easy FM.
You are listening to Roundtable. I'm your host, He Yang. Mr. Lee Harris, anchor of the radio show 1010 Winds in New York City, was with me hosting a roundtable discussion with university students from China and the U.S. The young people have their own way of looking at the differences and similarities between the two countries. Let's hear what the young people from both countries have to say.
What native cuisine of the Ozarks would you recommend to our Chinese friends?
Try the cashew chicken. See what we think. Let's find out what Americans think Chinese food is. I think it'd be interesting.
That's a good answer. What's real good American food? Is it KFC? Lily, please let me know.
So I am a child of immigrants, and I was an immigrant myself. So when I think of like what it means to have food in America, I actually think of like Chinese food. My mom really knows how to make a really good easy nanxiong shi mian. And that's like what's home to me. And when people from China will come here and they'll be like, oh, what American food should I have? You can get KFC in China, right? You can get McDonald's in China. I think one of the great things, and I think this is something as my pride as like an immigrant who is going to live here in America long term, America really is a country of immigrants. And so when you come here to Manhattan, I'll take you out for dim sum for breakfast. We can do hot pot at night, but I can also take you out for like Mexican food or pho or Asian fusion, like or whatever, right? Because it's all within like 20 blocks of each other. And I think like when you come to America, you want to eat American food, I would suggest you try everything.
No, it's very true. American food is basically
food from other countries.
Yeah.
So there are a few food named after historical people's name. One in America is called General Tso's chicken, which I had no idea why people are interested in eating that. But then I tried, I find I really love it. But I also want to recommend a food to you. It's a traditional Hui cuisine. It's called Li Hongzhang Hodgepodge. So Li Hongzhang is a Chinese historical figure in late Qing Dynasty. And when he visited the U.S. and hosted a banquet for his American friends, then the chef found out that there wasn't much food ingredients left. So upon his order, the chefs just put everything in a like impromptu stew containing foods like sea cucumber, ham, chicken meat, mushroom, and you name it. And then people find out it's really good, and people love it. So it becomes a very famous dish in China right now. So please ask your Chinese friend to like take you try this. Li Hongzhang Hodgepodge. That's my favorite too.
Writing that down.
Okay. Actually, I have two small tips for Americans who want to try Chinese food. Tip number one, do not go to Panda Express. And tip number two, when you try hot pot like Li Hongzhang hot pot, do not use your hands, because I once have hot pot with Indian friends who tried to use their hands to eat hot pot. Do not do that, otherwise you will
you will be heard. So that's two small tips for Americans who want to try Chinese food.
I don't know what you have against Panda Express. I've eaten there many times. The panda is delicious.
I want to share something that my mother really, really loves, some Chinese food. My mother is not a fancy woman. She loves eating chicken feet. I know for a lot of Americans, it's very hard to accept. But once you try it, you never know. You know, I have this American friend, Mark, who spent 30 years in China, got used to everything, in every kind of Chinese food, including intestines, brains. But he doesn't eat chicken feet because he thought it was too much work. But I think it represents the spirits of Chinese people, hardworking and making use of everything.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think whatever differences may exist between the U.S. and China, we can all agree on the food, with the possible exception of the chicken feet.
Yes.
We have some other questions that we pose to the international audience, and we'll also bring up to you as well. And that regards student societies focusing on Chinese culture at NYU. Mm-hmm. Are there any? I guess that would be best directed to NYU students.
Societies and student clubs in NYU? Yes, Lily.
Oh, yeah, there are a ton. Chinese Student Scholar Associate, CSSA. We have a Chinese May Society that focuses on our Taiwanese population. And there's a lot of every year. There's also one that's focused on the Hong Kong Society. And every year in the spring, around New Year's time, they'll hold events. Last year, their theme was Yuan. And so they'll have Chinese clubs from all over school, whether they be from focus on Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland China, and they'll come together to share food, to share performances, and it's actually a really big event. Usually they charge $5 to $10.
What kind of participation do you get from non-Chinese students? What kind of participation do you get from non-Chinese students?
Oh, Chinese students will just tell their friends, oh, I worked on this super hard, please come. So people will come, actually.
That's good. And if you were going, aside from that argument, if you were going to make a persuasive argument as to why somebody who is not Chinese and maybe doesn't have any Chinese friends would want to come and take part, what would you tell them?
It's in English, and it's super fun.
I'm in.
Yeah, people want some fun, I guess. And
also free food.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, the two most powerful words in the English language when used in combination, free and food.
You can't beat that one. And also this morning when I was doing a little bit of research and getting to know NYU better, I was very impressed by the orientation that you guys held at NYU. And apparently NYU has 450 student societies, clubs, and NYU students. Do you have any recommendations, or you think this is outrageous? How could we have to let you know this kind of student society that you like to tell the world? We've got an online audience that's far more people than those who are sitting with us right now. What would you say to them?
Well, I did want to say, touching back on Chinese societies, this was an unfortunate story that was shared with me by a friend who is biracial. She's Chinese and American. Raised her a lot of her life in Beijing, and she went to the club fest that we have that has a good portion of those 400 clubs that we have at NYU. And as she went down the list for the Chinese organizations, she got a lot of pushback where people didn't recognize that she was Chinese, and she felt that was kind of ostracizing. So I think that's interesting that sometimes Chinese student societies, there is a fine line depending on do they exist just for Chinese students or do they exist for people who are interested in Chinese mm-hmm. culture as well. And I think that could be negotiated individually mm-hmm. by each club. But if you wanted a recommendation about a club, there's not one that I'm in, but an organization that NYU has called APA Bridge is something that's had a really big impact, because rather than being an organization that focuses just on culture, holidays, festivities, which are all very valid and important things to recognize, mm-hmm. APA Bridge also works to bring political recognition for the experience of Asian Pacific Americans in the United States. So this is an organization that leads discussions and talks on campus that talk about the issues that Asians face as they come to the United States, mm-hmm. whether it's dual identities, whether it's Asian American, being Asian, coming to the United States. And I think they're doing really good work to draw more awareness to some of the issues that it faces, the reality of being Asian American.
Thank you very much for that recommendation. Thank you.
There are a lot of like interesting clubs in NYU, for example, like Coffee Club. My roommates in that club is like super fond of it. I don't understand why. And yeah, there are like breakdance clubs. Sorry, what I'm talking. Breakdance club. There's the one they call like beatbox club, if you know what is it. That kind of thing. So basically, as quirky as you want, yeah.
Yeah, that is pretty quirky. And culture is a very powerful thing, just like you guys have said earlier. While we were doing the survey, there was one finding that was 60% of the U.S. respondents say that they've never had any chance to have a tad or a taste of Chinese culture or understand what this is about. And I think that is interesting. That shows, I think, more of these kind of talks need to happen.
I have a question that's actually not on the menu, but it came up in the findings earlier in the first question, which was the perception of Chinese students by American students and vice versa, and the Chinese students were seen as hardworking and intelligent. How do you guys feel about being collectively seen in that light?
Well, since I'm studying education policy, I knew there are a lot of research report about the reading and math performance for K-12 education, which means that the students from kindergarten to high school. So from those reports, they always look at how Asian students are like top the performance level. So for me, that's in education because people want to find out the minority groups, those like they have why they're grades are not that good. So I think that's what why people's first impression came from when speaking of education performance. So that's from my perspective. And we also trying to look at how people can like get different like learning experience from each other's perspective as well.
So we saw that the American students were perceived by the Chinese as sort of open and easygoing, which might be code words for maybe a little lazy, or what were we getting at there?
I think that's also from the first impression.
Yeah.
But I would like look more about the combination of performance, including the extracurricular performance and the other like aspects of learning.
There is this experiment that I always refer to. So in America, there are two dominant stereotypes. One is that Asians are good at math. Second is that women are bad at math. So researchers had two compare groups. And one group, there are two groups of Asian women doing the same level of mathematic problems. And group A was required to put down their gender. Group 2 was required to put down their ethnicity. So it turned out for the same group of people doing the same math problems, when you put down your ethnicity, you perform better.
Yeah.
Because the stereotype of Asians are good at math and women are bad at math are affecting your performance. So I think the reason we have different first impressions, a lot of it has many things to do with stereotypes with each other. So dialogues like this are important because we get to know each other as human beings and we see many similarities that we failed to see before. And I think that's very, very important.
Of course, true or untrue, it's not the worst reputation to have, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if it's all right if I touch on that. And I know that I am not Asian, I'm not from China. But I do think that from what I hear from people who live their entire lives in America being told that they're good, they're supposed to be good at math, they're supposed to be good at science, these hard facts, what does that do to you if you're not? And I think that goes for a lot of different stereotypes, is that what if you don't fit into that stereotype and how it affects you? So I think I look forward to the day where we don't necessarily have to bring up, well, Chinese people are supposed to be good at math. Instead, we don't even have to mention it at all and just talk about the reality of what Chinese people can do that isn't representative of all of them.
Mm.
I also want to bring about a report. It came in 1983, which is called A Nation at Risk. I think most of American educators knew that report because it gives students the rankings around the world. And I believe that students from Hong Kong and from Singapore, those Asian districts, are ranked very high levels. So that's why American educators started talking about education and started about talking about the reform that they can bring to American students. That's another illustration of my previous point.
Yeah, and then just jumping off that really quick, I think something we're seeing now a lot in both countries' education system is Americans trying to adopt the hardworking, kind of diligent work ethic that Chinese students seem to have, and Chinese schools trying to pick up the kind of entrepreneurial or creative momentum that they believe that American students have. But I think it's interesting, again, that we're kind of looking large scale and attaching these kind of educational values to the cultural landscape of one another's countries. So thinking about, can we really adopt the same type of methods and the same type of skills that students in China have as Americans within a different cultural context? So that's one thing I find interesting between the two countries.
I think the problem lies in the population we have. We have 1.3 billion people in China, which means we cannot adopt the same education system with US. Think about that. If you have to write personal essay and a personal description to apply the university you want to apply for, but in China it's impossible to read so many essays of your self-introduction. So we adopt the college entrance examination. So which means we only see the scores you perform, how much scores you get in that examination, instead of what kind of person you are. And the second thing is that about the job market, 1.3 billion people means that in US, maybe the same job, two people competing for one job, but in China, it becomes 10 persons competing for one job. So we are hardworking, but it doesn't mean we want to be hardworking ourselves. It's just we are pushed to be like that. So I think the problem is the population.
There's another aspect of it I find quite interesting as well, that is confidence. And it's a bit of a stereotype, but I want to know what specifically American students have to say about this, that Chinese people tend to think that Americans, why are you so confident? We want to be like that, but how did you become that? But when you approach people, you're exuding confidence. Do you agree with that? Okay, Franklin.
No, I mean, I'm not American, but I may have a very simple explanation for this, which is those American who are not so confident may not even get approached to Chinese students. So basically, every Chinese student is getting in touch with those who have the guts to talk with them. That's probably one of the biggest reasons, because I'm in an institute that I'm the only Asian. So, yeah, I can see there are some people who are actually very introspective. And then I realize it's not just abnormal thing. They're everywhere, but it's just they don't talk to you. So the problem is that you may not even be aware of them. Mm. People of all kinds are here in America, and those who are confident may just be the one who just approached you.
I was just going to explain. I think a lot like what we were touching on earlier is the way you're raised really conditions based on the stereotypes that are about you. So as a female growing up, I felt I, had to be less confident. There is a study that came out that freshman women have much higher levels of confidence than senior women. And that high, big universities, a lot of women lose their confidence through the years. I think that has a lot to do with American society and media in which we are portrayed. But I do like Franklin's point about if you're confident, you are more apt to approach other people. But there is this sense of faking till you make it. I know, like, I have gained confidence also by faking it. it does help. But, yeah, I do think that we do sometimes come across as confident, even if it's not necessarily true. Mm. But, like, there are all types of people in, you know, every country. So
yeah. It is the American way.
The fake it till you make
it? Fake it till you make it, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Learning something today.
You know, done it a bit myself, now and then, occasionally. Not right now.
Yeah, I might say something about the notion of the American dream. So the U.S. as we know it, I mean, it was discovered by Native Americans quite a long time ago, but the U.S. that the world sees today as the U.S. was discovered a little before 1500, and things didn't really get going until 1800s. So just the idea that we've built ourselves really from scratch in 300 years from really nothing, just raw materials in the land, into one of the world's greatest superpowers, I guess, helps build that confidence. And in a lot of cases, that confidence sort of becomes arrogance in a way. Americans a lot of times can't see that they're part of the problem rather than the solution. I mean, with the whole climate change idea, a lot of times Americans like to point fingers, and we don't really see that we are a huge impact on it as well. I mean, who here likes beef? A couple people. Okay, thank you for the high level of interaction. So Americans like beef. Like, that's not really an obscure fact. And by some estimates, 1 pound of beef requires, through, you know, the feed and whatever used to feed the cow, 1 pound of beef requires as much as 1,200 gallons of water. And, you know, the per capita consumption of beef among Americans is something like 50 pounds. So when you multiply that by the annual consumption of beef and the number of Americans there are, the amount of water that's required becomes huge. And, like, things like that just don't cross the mind of Americans. We always say, like, oh, China is burning so much coal, and they're using, they like to use endangered animals in their medicines and whatnot. And, you know, the situation in China has gotten a lot better. China has gotten a lot better about using renewable energy and cutting the trade on endangered animals. That idea of the American dream, I guess, plays into the notion of American confidence. And it's not necessarily always a good thing, so as I mentioned.
I'd also say there's a distinction that we should make between confidence and maybe brashness or being talkative, because I don't know. I think that for me personally, that confidence comes from a place of really deep understanding of self. And I don't know that that's something that's, you know, that's closed off only to Americans. I think that's accessible to people across cultures, across, you know, race and ethnicity. But I think that a lot of this ability or feeling the entitlement to cross certain boundaries happens a lot in childhood and the way that the family unit is structured in American culture versus Chinese culture. And I think that in American culture, there's a lot more focus on the individual rather than focus on the family or focus on the community. And there's a lot more ability for children to overstep the boundaries of their parents, or to talk back or to challenge or to push back. And I think that as a child, being able to do that to someone who is of utmost authority in your life, I think that also shows once you grow older. Though I don't necessarily call that confidence, I would call that more a brashness or a feeling that we're entitled to, you know, perhaps speak on or cross boundaries with other people in our lives.
Doing research, I have a feeling the more I learn, the less I feel like I know. So that happens to a lot of researchers. You might find them not, like, very talkative, which make people think they're not confident enough. But when they write in English and when they publish, you will find how much knowledge they have. That's incredible amount of knowledge that you might know. So I think sometimes being confident does not mean that you have to, like, be loud. You have, sometimes you can be quiet, but confident as well. That's my opinion.
There is quiet confidence. We have the final question for the panel, and you're all smart young people with plans and eyes on the future, and in some cases, I'm guessing you have your lives a little mapped out, looking all the way to 2020, which is the year that we set as our focus tonight. And the question is, where will you be in 2020, and how will that relate to the relationship between China and the U.S.? You know, will you be in one of these two countries, and will you be working to improve relations and maybe cross the cultures?
So I think in 2020, I'd like to be starting either the planning or the founding of a K-12 school, or in this going to be K-1 or 2, potentially in New York or D.C. And I think that when it comes to education and when it comes to educating primary level students, there is a big question of what do we get to choose that these students learn, which is a huge question, right, which shapes who they become as academics, as people, as daughters and friends. So I think that thinking about where does Chinese fall into the curriculum, where does cross-cultural competence fall into the curriculum, and how, when do students start becoming, when do we start teaching these kinds of lessons to students? Do we start when they're in kindergarten? Do we start when they're in middle school or when they're in high school? And how do we introduce these types of topics to students, especially in the context of this globalized world and helping students understand what does global really mean, right, from an American perspective? Is global really the equal access of all cultures in this like kind of large worldly melting pot, or is it dominated by certain cultures and certain languages and certain races? So I think that a lot of these global issues are going to be folded into the curriculum in the next 5-10 years and beyond.
So you're at least contemplating teaching Mandarin in your school when you set it up?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think it has to do with language. I think there's also culture and also the relationship that students have with one another, right, with Chinese American students and non-Chinese students.
Yeah, very cool. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else who wants to say a little bit about what do you see yourself in the future and also
2020
Sino.
Specifically, yeah. Not 2019 and not 2021.
Yeah, so only in 4 years' time. Let's be specific.
Okay, in 2020, I hope that I can be a doctoral student, getting my doctoral degree and start to teach. And also, I would like to help you start a
Aww.
School. Because I'm very grateful that we can have this opportunity and find some common ground on certain topics. And we definitely will keep in touch after this event.
And that brings us to the end of today's roundtable. Thank you so much for your company. We are Easy FM Roundtable on WeChat. You can send us a message to get in touch. You'll also be able to find information on the hosts, events and activities, and receive the latest updates of the show. Or you can leave us your thoughts and see in a Weibo. Just key in 轻松调频 Roundtable. If you're a podcast listener, we're Roundtable 圆桌会议 there. Have yourselves a wonderful day. Bye-bye, everybody.